From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. stock market plunged at the open this morning, responding to the arrest of a senior Chinese technology executive, which threatens to worsen trade tensions between China and the U.S. Mengwan Zhou, the chief financial officer and daughter of the founder of the tech giant Huawei, was arrested by Canadian authorities last Saturday at the request of the U.S. American officials say she violated U.S. sanctions on Iran. They want her extradited. But the arrest came on the same day President Trump met with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the G20 in Argentina. Trump called that meeting extraordinary, indicating that tensions were easing. Well, they have ratcheted up. Robert Daly is director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. He joins us from Washington. Robert, your reaction to the arrest?
Well, I think that I was as surprised as the Wall Street traders. Certainly, this is enormous news, and it's also very big in China. It's an imperfect analogy, but imagine, for example, that Sheryl Sandberg transiting the Philippines was detained at the request of China for possible extradition to China because of Facebook's various accusations against Facebook. That's how big this is for the Chinese listener.
Well, look, the Commerce Department has done this before with a Chinese telecom company, ZTE, in April. The U.S. barred American firms from exporting to it as punishment for violating U.S. sanctions. But this is such a sensitive time because of the trade talks. What do you think happened? Trump wants to ease tensions with China. Could U.S. officials have put this off? Was it purposeful to send a message? Or was it, you know, maybe a cross signal within the administration?
I think it's probably the latter. Tellingly, there has been no statement yet from the White House, the Department of Justice, or from the State Department. And because this is going to be such a major story in China and will raise suspicions in the Chinese government and among the Chinese populace about American intentions, this is not helpful for trade negotiations with China. And so I think that there's a chance that this was a lack of coordination and a coincidence and not part of a concerted plan to increase pressure on China.
Huh. Well, Huawei, again, the world's biggest supplier of network gear used by phone and internet companies, long a target of U.S. security officials. Criminal probes been going on for a while. Huawei says it's not aware of any wrongdoing by Meng. The company said it complies with all laws and regulations. What do you think?
Well, we know little about the specific accusations. There's going to be a hearing in Canada tomorrow. We may get some more information then. We do know that Iran is very important to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is about investment, but is also about connectivity. China has been very critical of America's pulling out of the Iran agreement. And we know that ZTE, the company you already mentioned, another China-based telecoms company, did in fact violate sanctions and exported American equipment to both Iran and to North Korea. So there is a precedent for this, but we have no reliable information as yet.
Well, as we said, everything is intersecting here. You've got national security, high-tech business, our overall commercial relationship, which has been in peril, you know, because of the tariffs. And yet we have White House security advisor John Bolton telling Steve Inskeep today on NPR that he knew about this arrest over the weekend. What do you make of that, given that you're saying that this might have been miscommunications in the Trump administration?
Well, or non-communications or a lack of coordination. And again, we don't know. This is speculative, and there's been no formal word from the White House as yet. My hope is that this is based on very reliable, specific evidence that Meng herself was involved in egregious sanctions violations in exporting American equipment to Iran. If that is true, then it might make sense for the Department of Justice to treat this as a criminal case quite apart from the negotiations. But if this derives instead from our really quite justified broad suspicions of Huawei, or if it is using Ms. Meng, Mengwan Zhou, as sort of a representative of Huawei as a whole, then I think that it will constitute a misstep. But we're really waiting for more solid information.
A misstep, again, given the importance of the trade talks. Look, there's also the concern that this is China we're talking about. It's a family company, but it might be used by the Chinese to, you know, the technology might be used to expand China's own spying. Is that a part of this equation?
That's absolutely part of the equation, and it's long been a suspicion in Washington. It's a reason that the United States, Australia, and New Zealand are not allowing Huawei to participate in the development of 5G technologies. Canada and Britain are a little more involved with Huawei, but they also share these suspicions. And as you say, it's a privately held family company, but no Chinese company, right, state-owned or private, is going to defy the Communist Party if they are asked to take specific actions. So there's always a strong element of Chinese government direction here.
Yeah. That's Robert Daly, director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. We wait to see if Ms. Meng will be extradited. Robert Daly, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the head of North Carolina's Republican Party says he's open to a new election in the state's 9th congressional district if state officials find substantial evidence of election fraud. In one of the last unresolved races of the midterm elections, Republican Mark Harris is 905 votes ahead of his Democratic opponent, Dan McCready. But there are allegations that absentee ballots were illegally gathered by someone working for the Harris campaign. Joining us now is WUNC politics reporter Rusty Jacobs. Rusty, there have been a lot of developments today. What's the latest at this point?
Yeah, it's been a busy day already. A group of Republican state senators got together and called on the governor to form a bipartisan task force to investigate not only wrongdoing in the 2018 elections in Bladen County, the center of some of the alleged wrongdoing here, but also past election cycles. Governor has already responded. His spokesman gave me a statement saying, we just want the investigation to continue, the State Board of Elections investigation, and other investigations that have been undertaken by state prosecutors. And then, as you've noted, Dallas Woodhouse, chair of the state Republican Party, has said he supports delay in certification, the certification of this victory, supposed victory by Mark Harris, and letting the investigation lead where it may, even if that means a new election.
And what would a new election mean? Would that mean starting over from scratch or having the same candidates run again? What?
It would mean essentially the race being done over, including a libertarian candidate. There was a third candidate in the race who didn't get nearly as many votes, obviously, as the Democrat and the Republican. But it would, and that's one thing that the state party chair, the Republican chair, Dallas Woodhouse, keeps saying. He's saying, look, this is a huge step because we're talking about what he calls disenfranchising several hundred thousand voters who did vote legally. But we're talking about Bladen County and actually Robeson County, two counties where an inordinate number of absentee ballots were requested but not returned. And so that has raises a lot of suspicions for people.
And the suspicion centers on a political operative named McCray Dallas. What exactly is he accused of?
Well, it looks he's accused personally. Data has shown, data released by the State Board of Elections during their investigation so far shows that he's personally handled hundreds of absentee ballot requests and turning them in. Essentially, we're talking about one of two misdeeds here, or really two misdeeds. One would be actually altering people's ballots, either offering to fill them in for those people or changing them once they've been filled in and gathering them and offering to deliver them to the State Board of Elections. And then the other is actually discarding people's absentee ballots. State law requires absentee voters to submit those ballots by themselves or a near relative. But anybody other than that, it would be illegal.
So it's not required that they mail the absentee ballots. It is you could actually give them to somebody else to take in for you?
You could not. You have to mail them in, or if you're turning them in personally, it has to be you or a near relative.
Or a relative. Okay.
Correct.
All right. So the local TV station WSOC got interviews with two women this week who claimed that Dallas paid them to collect ballots. One is named Cheryl Kinlaw. Listen.
I feel bad now that I know that it wasn't legal, but I did at the time, I didn't know.
Wow. There was already an investigation underway into absentee ballots involving Dallas dating back to 2016. What are Dallas and the Harris campaign saying about all this?
Not much at this point. I want to switch back for a second to Dallas Woodhouse, who's a spokesman in a sense for North Carolina Republicans. His position has kind of changed, and it may reflect what many Republicans are now saying, that there's a real pause, there's a real concern that there is actual evidence of wrongdoing here and that a delay is proper. Dallas Woodhouse noted that the U.S. House of Representatives ultimately will be the arbiter in this case. They will retain jurisdiction over whether Mark Harris gets to be seated. So even if the State Board of Elections investigation is disrupted or for some reason discontinued, the House of Representatives, with a Democratic majority come January 3rd, could elect to not seat Mark Harris until an investigation is completed.
And are people there preparing for that?
every people are preparing for every kind of outcome. As you noted, it's a busy day already. Developments on many, many fronts. But when you have the chair of the Republican Party, and even one of the state senators, Republican senators who was talking today, he said, I wouldn't have certified this race if it were up to me. So everybody is acknowledging that there's evidence of real, very strong evidence of possible wrongdoing.
Are people surprised that this is going on, or do people feel like that this is, you know, the way that things are handled in this county?
It's surprising that we're talking about a congressional race possibly being overturned and having to be done over. What you do hear from a lot of political participants and observers in the state is that the fact that this is taking place in Bladen County, the fact that this takes place in Robeson County and involving absentee ballots, it's actually not surprising. The Republican senators calling for a bipartisan task force have talked about past election cycles with the same kinds of problems, and why haven't they been solved? So unfortunately, this kind of chicanery is not unusual.
Rusty Jacobs at WUNC in North Carolina, thank you.
You're welcome.
Paris is going to close the Eiffel Tower and other tourist sites this weekend due to more planned demonstrations, even after the French government promised to drop new fuel taxes from next year's budget following violent protests by the Yellow Vest movement. That was seen as a surrender by President Emmanuel Macron. Let's bring in Vincent Michelot, who is a professor of American politics at Sciences Po Lyon. Professor, do you think the offer to drop these new taxes will be enough for the protesters?
No, it's not. Definitely not going to be enough. It's, by all accounts, too little too late, because the movement of the Yellow Jackets or the Yellow Vests has morphed from a protest about potential increases on the price of gasoline into a more general protest about taxation on the lower middle class as opposed to taxation on the upper middle class and on the super wealthy.
Now, explain the protest, first of all. Where did they start? These people, the reason they're called Yellow Vests is because they're wearing these roadside construction crew jackets, which I guess has become a symbol of the working class.
Well, not so much because of construction crew, but those yellow vests are security vests that you have to have in your car in case you have an accident and you're on the side of the road. And it all started from the plan of the Macron government to increase taxes on gas in general, but even more so on diesel gasoline, which most of those people use for their own cars because traditionally it has been cheaper than regular gasoline. And this is a movement of people who, for most of them, live on the outskirts of the cities and use their cars on a daily basis to go to work, to take their kids to school, to go to the doctors. It's the equivalent, not in the United States, of the suburbs, but rather of the exurbs.
What happened to Macron? When he came into power, people were very excited about him. He was this young, new face for France. He said he was going to revitalize the French economy and make it more business friendly. And people seem to be going along with it, at least for a little bit. And then now they've turned on him.
Well, what happened with Emmanuel Macron is simply that there was much too much that was promised and not enough that he could deliver. Mm. And for example, he was elected on the premise that France was past or beyond the left-right divide. Well, the left-right divide still exists. And as a result, there's this general idea that Macron has delivered a lot for the wealthy families, for investors. For example, one of the things that's been very much in the news lately is the fact that Macron started off by canceling a tax on the super rich. Both on the right and on the left, you have this call for a notable increase of the minimum salary. And this is aggregating to the demand that taxes on new taxes on gas be canceled. And Macron is not a magician. France is part of Europe. It has to be under 3% of deficit in terms of the GDP. Mm-hmm. And after a year and a half in power, he is simply confronted with the limitations of transitioning from two models in terms of energy, while at the same time remaining in Europe and wanting to play a leadership role in Europe.
Is it possible that Macron would resign?
No.
So the prime minister in France, Edouard Philippe, said today that 65,000 security forces are going to be deployed nationwide this weekend because they're worried about a repeat of what we saw last weekend, torched cars, looted shops, defacing the Arc de Triomphe, the worst unrest Paris has seen in five decades. What are you expecting this weekend?
It is extremely difficult to predict anything simply because the movement has no representatives. Some people have been shocked by the violence last Saturday and say, don't go to Paris. Other people are saying this now is the time to increase the pressure on the government because we are finally getting something that we've been demanding. And on top of it, contrary to tradition in France, where you have to notify the police of where and how you're going to demonstrate, this movement does no such thing, which means that the police is at a loss in trying to organize in preparation for Saturday's demonstrations.
That is Vincent Michelot, who is a professor of American politics at Sciences Po Lyon in France. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's go to Germany now, where tomorrow Angela Merkel will step down as leader of her party, the Christian Democratic Union Party, which meets this weekend to choose her successor. It's the first step in what will be the end of her reign as chancellor. In October, she said she wouldn't run again when her fourth term ends in 2021. So what does all of this mean? The BBC's Damian McGuinness is in Berlin. Damian, remind us why this is happening. I mean, Merkel was sort of a beacon, but that's been dimming.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. So she is essentially not putting herself forward as the next party leader at this party conference. So in a sense, you could say she's not stepping down. She is simply not standing for re-election. But what this is essentially, you're quite right, the end of the Merkel era. The reason why this is all happening is a number of defeats or poor results, really, of her own party in regional elections over the past year. And this is essentially all going back to the high numbers of migrants and refugees who've arrived in Germany over the past few years, because this has led to an anti-migrant party, the Alternative for Germany. There is, among people who don't want migrants to come to Germany, a bit of dissatisfaction with Angela Merkel's party and her government.
Well, and her, because she was the one who was taking the stand that the migrants needed to be helped.
Yeah, that's right, Robin. So for many years now, she's become the face of Germany welcoming in refugees and migrants. Having said that, in reality, over the past year or two, her policies have really changed. So Germany has actually become less welcoming to migrants, you could say, mm-hmm. and has really done a lot to control borders more efficiently, and also sending back migrants who have failed their applications for asylum. So the policies have changed a lot over the past year or two. But you're quite right, she still represents, for many people who object to migration, she represents a pro-refugee policy. So this is one of the reasons she recognises this. Having said that, though, she's still popular with mainstream Germany, so her personal ratings are still quite high. But what she's done within her party, she dragged it to the centre. She's disappointed a lot of conservatives and right-wingers within her party. So some of the conservative end of her party see her as a liability, and they're looking for reform. They're looking for a bit of change. And so that's why they're now choosing the party leader in order to look forward to the next set of elections.
And what does it mean? We know that there are right-leaning and nationalist movements all across Europe. Does this mean that Germany is being tugged to the right?
Well, it really depends who ends up running this party. So there are a couple of different contenders, and some of them a more centrist like Mrs. Merkel, and they would keep on her moderate course, as some would describe it, keep her centrist course going. Some of them are more conservative, and that's really the question facing this party, which would then have a big influence on the whole of Germany. Mm-hmm. So the two main leaders, there's a woman called Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. It's a bit of a mouthful. So mm-hmm. in German media, she's often called AKK, and she is a Merkel ally. She's seen as quite similar to Merkel in how she operates. And the other front runner is Friedrich Merz, who is much more right-wing, and he has a business background. He's getting a lot of excitement among right-wingers because he's seen as someone who could shake up the party.
Just an observation. It's interesting how Germany's become so comfortable with female leaders. But Germany has Europe's largest economy. Merkel has been seen as Europe's most powerful leader. At times, she's been at the front of the pack, taking stands on things. What's the sense of, how Germany will fare after this change?
As I say, Merkel is still very popular within the center ground, and mainstream voters still like her because this era is someone who can strike deals. And a lot of people would say, well, that's what you need right now, because we've got quite a few assertive characters in international politics, to put it mildly. And she's
Of our president? Is that
thinking? There are quite a few strong characters around, let's just put it like that. And Mrs. Merkel is seen as someone who can talk to various different leaders, from Mr. Putin to Mr. Trump. So yeah. She's someone who is seen as can bring a bit of consensus in what is quite a difficult debate sometimes in the international arena. But at the same time, she's also seen as someone who has almost destroyed the party system here in Germany. And that's because she's sat in the middle for so long. And there is a theory that this is why we now have the extremes getting stronger. This is why we have this right-wing populist AfD party on the left, on the right, and we have the Green Party on the left doing very well. So there's a lot of theories that actually this is partly Mrs. Merkel's fault that we have more radical parties now, and that if we got back to this more right-left conservative versus left-wing style, which a more conservative leader of her party would do, then this would be healthy for the whole party landscape. So that's something that some people do think here in Germany.
Fascinating. The BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin. Damian, thank you.
Pleasure.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Let's get back to our top story. The arrest of a high-powered Chinese tech executive at the Vancouver airport on Saturday that's putting new pressure on U.S.-China relations. The chief financial officer of the Chinese tech giant Huawei was arrested in Canada for allegedly violating U.S. sanctions against Iran. American officials want the executive, Meng Wanzhou, extradited to the U.S. But Huawei is not the first company accused of violating sanctions against Iran. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure, for that part of the story. Hi, Robin.
How are you, sir?
And doing well. But first of all, tell us what Huawei is accused of doing here.
Some of the accusations are vague, but you could see that Huawei's priorities, it is huge in next generation network. It's thrown billions into research on 5G networks that are involved with driverless cars, factories, remote medical services, and clearly China's master of surveillance within technology. And so that's a national champion company that they are loath to miss opportunities on.
So what are they accused of when it comes to Iran and violating the sanctions?
So in trading with Iran or offering commerce or offering network services or consulting or equipment, that is the allegation here, that China is in violation of U.S. sanctions by endeavoring to do business ostensibly with Iranian telco companies and even defense contractors.
How common is that? How many other companies are either being accused of this or maybe doing it and haven't yet been charged with anything?
Jeremy, in full daylight, it's hard for a multinational to get away with this day in and day out, but it's very possible and actually widespread to use back channels. If you want to use a flagless ship to get goods to third parties, that distribute them inside Iran. You can go to the island of Kish or to North Tehran, for example, and you can get the latest iPhones and AirPods. So it's a function of if you have the cash. And we've seen it over 30, 40 years of ongoing sanctions between the United States and Iran. Cheating is kind of the order of the day.
And why do the companies want to risk it?
Iran's just an eager customer. It's willing to pay top yuan, top euro, top pound for vital parts, aircraft, petroleum, public infrastructure, defense. That kind of equipment has been neglected in the four decades of embargoes since the revolution. And the biggest Chinese, European, or even South Korean conglomerates, they really hate to leave that money on the table.
So what's going on now after the U.S. Pulled out of the multi-party Iran nuclear deal? The Europeans were very interested in doing a lot of business with Iran. The U.S. was trying to put pressure on them not to do that anymore. What's the status of that?
Well, what you're seeing is a tough negotiation among the continents. The Europeans also have their national champions. If you look at Siemens or Unilever or British Petroleum, and right now there are contentious negotiations for extensions and exemptions. And even then, everybody knows that there are back channels and less monitored routes. And for the United States, enforcement's just brutally difficult. If you look at a snapshot of all the supercargo ships on the coast of China and everything going in and out of the Persian Gulf or on trucks through the mountains between Iran and Afghanistan. I mean, that gives you an idea.
And are we still hearing, I mean, you're of Iranian descent. I assume you've got some connections still to this day. You know kind of what's going on maybe inside the country. Are you hearing that the economy is still as bad as it has been just in a few seconds we've got?
It's in bad shape because there was so much euphoria in the Obama administration that there'd be a normalization of trades. Like, I wanted to open a Chipotle in Tehran, and here I am still as a journalist, you know?
Robin Farzad, still host of podcast Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Tomorrow is the end of this year's open enrollment period to sign up for Medicare. So if you're about to hit 65 or are older or have parents that age, listen up because Medicare is confusing. There's A, B, C, D, and then supplemental plans like Medigap, and there are 10 of those. But Julie Rovner is here. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a two-track conversation here. Yes, there's this open enrollment going on. I want to talk about that. But there's also just plain signing up for Medicare when you are about to turn 65. Something I'm hearing a lot anecdotally, people saying, I don't need Medicare. I have a great job and I have great employer insurance. For instance, I have a friend who just ignored this mailer that came telling him to do something about Medicare, whatever he didn't think about. He's too busy working. And then he had a health crisis, first in a hospital, then rehab. Then suddenly he was paying $2,000 a day that his insurance didn't pick up, but plain old Medicare would have as a secondary. He had no idea.
You know, what's really important is that Medicare is much beloved, but it's also very complicated. Mm-hmm. There are actually sort of three types of open enrollment for Medicare. The one that we're in now that ends at the end of this week is the time when anybody on Medicare can change their plan. But every single person has their own open enrollment. The first one comes when you turn 65, when you are eligible if you've worked 10 years, 40 quarters, to sign up for Part A, which is the hospital part, hospital and nursing home part of Medicare. And that's free. You don't have to pay a premium if you've worked enough quarters, but you need to sign up for it. And the other part is Part B. That's the outpatient part of Medicare. And when you stop working, if you no longer have employer insurance, that's when you sign up for Part B and Part D, which is the prescription drug part. I know it's really confusing.
I was just
going to
say, let's do a review since we don't have a whiteboard. This is radio. So that first part, the just kind of signing up for Medicare Part A, which is hospital, even if you already have insurance, that's the part that can be your secondary and pick up extra costs that your employer insurer might not cover.
Absolutely correct. If you're already on Social Security, you'll be signed up for Part A automatically. But if you're still working, you have to affirmatively tell Social Security, yes, I'm still working, but I'm turning 65. I want Part A. Well, it's really important to do that if you work for an employer with fewer than 20 employees, because in that case, Medicare becomes your primary insurer. Mm-hmm. If you work for a larger firm, it becomes your secondary insurer. So what your employer insurance doesn't pay, Medicare might.
Okay. So that's this first, as you call it, open enrollment. It's your own personal open enrollment and anyone else who shares your birthday. You get a mailing. Don't throw it away. You have to respond. If you are in a company and already have great insurance, it will supplement that. If you're in a very small company, this becomes your insurance. Okay, so that's the first thing. So talk more about what's happening now. And you mentioned that there's different kinds of Medicare. There's the Part A hospital, Part B, that's, you know, doctors, all that kind of medical care. Let's say you just had that Part A the first time you registered. Now you don't have that job anymore. There's an open enrollment and you're realizing, my employer insurance is gone. You need to think about what?
Then you have to think about what kind of supplemental insurance you want, because for all of how wonderful Medicare is for most of its beneficiaries, it doesn't cover a lot of things. So you will need some kind of supplement. You can stay in the traditional Medicare program where you can go to any doctor or hospital you want. Then you can buy a Medigap plan, a supplemental plan that covers most of literally the gaps in Medicare, your deductibles and your copayments. And then you can buy a Part D plan, a prescription drug plan that comes separately. And those are the things that you can change during open enrollment every year. Or you can go into what's called a Medicare Advantage plan, which is Part C, which is a private plan that covers almost everything that Medicare doesn't, including drugs, sometimes dental and vision coverage. The trick with those is that once you've joined, you might not be able to go back to traditional Medicare and get a traditional supplement. Also, you must go and see only the providers that are signed up with that plan. So you have a much more limited group of providers. Those things are what you can change during the open enrollment every year that we're in now.
Okay, a review again is needed. So you have A for hospital, B for doctor and all that stuff, D for drugs. And then there's a C that might give you all of that, but it restricts the hospitals that you can go to.
And that's exactly right. And the doctors.
And there's a Medigap, which you can apply to buying A, hospital, B, doctor services, things like that, and D, drugs, that covers some of the gaps in those, like deductibles. And so as you buy these, are they shaped to you if you have a pre-existing condition, if you smoke or something? How does that affect Medicare purchases?
No, they're not at the beginning. When you're first eligible, everybody can buy a Medigap policy for the same price. The trick with the Medigap policies is that they are standardized. So they don't all cover the same things. They don't all cover the same amounts. There's several of them. And good thing about Medicare, there's a lot of places to go for help. There are senior centers that have assigned counselors. There are federal and state programs. Because it is complicated, and you do need somebody to walk you through it.
Yeah. Well, and you are helping us now, and we so appreciate it. You mentioned something I want to go back to. You said once you go to the Medicare Advantage, this plan that gives you A, B, and D, it's very hard to go back at another open enrollment to just traditional Medicare, maybe just the A and B, hospital and doctor's care. Why is it hard to go back?
Because the Medigap plans, the private supplemental plans, they only have guaranteed issue when you are first eligible. So if you go into a Medicare Advantage plan, a managed care plan, and then you get sick and you decide it doesn't have the doctors you want and you want to go back to traditional Medicare, you can go back to traditional Medicare, but you might not be able to get a regular Medigap plan anymore because now you have a pre-existing condition and now you're outside of that guaranteed issue window. So It can be tricky to go back and forth. A lot of people get caught in that trap.
Right. Look, Julie Rovner, you're not a consultant, and yet I'm going to ask you, what's the benefit of getting the A, hospital coverage, the B, doctors and all those services, the D, drug prescriptions, as opposed to C, the Medicare Advantage? Why is one better than the other?
One isn't better than the other, and this is one of those cases where it's good to have choices because some things are going to definitely be better for some people and other things are going to be better for other people. Part of it is how important it is to you to stick with your doctor if you have one and whether that doctor is part of a Medicare HMO or not. If you're very comfortable with your healthcare providers and they don't belong to one of these managed care plans, then you probably want to stay in traditional Medicare. If you're really worried about out-of-pocket spending and you want those extra benefits and you're okay with being in a managed care plan. A lot of people now turning 65 have been in managed care for a long time. That's why we're actually seeing enrollment go up. Those people are perfectly happy in Medicare Advantage. So it's a very individual choice.
Yeah. And Medigap, what should people look for to make sure it covers what they need?
You know, in some ways, it's a lot like car insurance. Sort of the more you pay in premiums, the less you'll pay out of pocket if you get sick and vice versa. So you really need to look at the different Medigap plans, what they cover, what the premiums are, you know, where you're comfortable with having a lot of insurance or not so much insurance, and what you might be exposed to.
Now, this 10 types of plans, we understand, and some plans pick up coinsurance costs for nursing facilities, some don't. Drug costs aren't included in Medigap.
No, because they're in Part D.
Right, in Part D.
They used to be in Medigap.
Right. And all but one plan pays in full or in part for Medicare's hospital deductible. So if you know you're going to be, you know, we can't always know, but sometimes you do know you're going to be visiting hospitals, we'll be thinking about the deductible when you pick up a Medigap. What's the biggest mistake people make, Julie, when they sign up?
I think one of the big mistakes people make is missing that open enrollment period. And remember, as we said, there's several of them there. You get sort of two for yourself, and then there's one every year. But if you miss signing up when you were supposed to sign up, you could pay a penalty into perpetuity. So you would have to pay a higher premium. And that does happen to a lot of people. So, you know, you do get a lot of mail, and a lot of them are ads. But it's really important to, as you're reaching 65 or as you're preparing to retire from your job, if you have employer health insurance, to really find out when those deadlines are and to meet them.
Well, and just the bottom line, so many people 65 and older are working. And that notion that you could go in for the unexpected, oh, knee replacement, and you don't show your Medicare card because that's nothing to me, I have insurance, that Medicare card could pick up extra costs and you don't even know it.
Yeah, this is the part of Medicare that people say, I've worked for this all my life and I've earned it. You have, and you should sign up for it.
Yes, there you go. Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thank you.
Dignitaries gathered in a Houston church today for one final chance to say goodbye to the 41st president. George H.W. Bush will be buried later this afternoon. His former Secretary of State, James Baker, said President Bush affected millions of lives.
He was not considered a skilled speaker, but his deeds were quite eloquent. And he demonstrated their eloquence by carving them into the hard granite of history.
A train is carrying the president's body from Houston to College Station, Texas, and he'll be buried next to his wife, Barbara, and their daughter, Robin. A story now about the northern saw-whet owl. The bird weighs less than a baseball and fits into the palm of your hand. One man in upstate New York is part of an international effort to learn more about them. But first, he has to catch one. North Country Public Radio's Doyle Dean reports.
It's a brisk fall afternoon, just before sunset, when I meet Mark Mansky on the trail behind his house. He puts the dogs inside while we talk.
Come on, you two. Come on now. Hey, come.
Mansky's a big man with a big smile. He's a retired high school biology teacher. Now he teaches at Paul Smith College, and he runs a company called Adirondack Raptors. He shows off his birds at public events, doing raptor outreach. His love affair with one raptor in particular, the saw-whet owl, began one night when he was sitting on his porch, tooting on his recorder.
And I was tooting away, and I had about eight of them all tooting back at me, and the moon was rising, and you could see the little bodies moving from branch to branch. It's pretty magical.
Tonight, Mansky and two volunteers, Tara Fuller and Jonas Borkholder, hope to catch saw-whet owls. They'll examine, band, and then release the birds. The bands each have a number, and each number will help tell each owl's story.
I'm chomping at the bit. I want to get rolling.
Tonight looks good for catching. There's a partial moon, a breeze, and it's cool.
Cool temperatures usually just after a front moves through, so the temperature's dropping is ideal. It gets the birds moving. So everything so far is perfect, perfect, perfect.
This is all part of Project OwlNet, an international effort to better understand the northern saw-whet owl. The birds aren't endangered now, but researchers are documenting their health and migration patterns in case anything changes. A row of mist nets line the trail. Mansky uses a cane to pull them into place. They're made of fine, soft fibers, and they've got little pockets for catching owls. It takes more than a net, though. You need to attract the birds. Mansky activates an audio lure that plays a saw-whet call. So here's the plan. We'll wait in Mansky's house, and every half hour, two of us will go check the nets. A couple of hours pass. Nothing. We go out again.
Oh. Can you hear that? That right?
Yeah, what was that?
That's the saw wet. That's saw wet. We got one around.
But there's nothing in the nets. Back at the house, coffee, conversation, check outside. And then the door swings open. Tara and Jonas burst through the door.
We have success. We have an owl.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
The owl is in a white mesh bag. It wiggles around. Mansky pulls the bird from the bag. Okay, I need to take a moment and say here that these birds are ridiculously cute. Little furry bodies, huge wide eyes. They look so cuddly. But they're fighters. They'll mess you up. Sharp beaks, strong talons. Mansky uses a gentle but firm hand. He weighs, measures, checks the owl's eye color, body fat, age. Then he places a band on the owl's leg. All this stuff goes into a notebook, and it will be entered into the database later. The owl makes an odd clacking noise.
Okay, I know, sweet pea, I know. You are beautiful, you really are. I know, and you're not happy, you're telling me off. And the clacking you're hearing, you know, I always thought it was the beak clacking. It actually is like them going,
oh,
you know.
Oh, it's in the back of their throat?
Yeah,
oh,
it's kind of, I know, I always thought it was the beak clacking.
What's the matter, Jonas?
Mansky places the bird back in the bag. Then he puts it on the dark porch to calm down before release. Time to check the nets again and band more owls.
Sawwhite owl looks like a sawwhite owl, looks like a sawwhite owl. They all look the same. They're a little brown bird. Until you put a band on it, all of a sudden now they become an individual.
Another owl is collected. It's brought inside and examined, and then Tara and Jonas walk out front to release the birds. Each wears a shiny new numbered band. Tara gently pulls an owl out of her bag. Before you know it, okay. Just like magic.
All right. And, oh, and that bird is also gone.
So it almost looked like it floated out of your hand.
It kind of did. It kind of was like a, just lifted off and flew away.
The sawwhite owls disappear into the night. And thanks to Mark Mansky, now they're individuals to us humans. They've got a history and data that will help researchers better understand them. For Here and Now, I'm Doyle Dean.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.